are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, January 2nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, partial shutdown of the government is ongoing, about to get worse for the Republicans and Trump, but nowhere as bad as it is for government workers. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren all but makes it official. 2020 is already here. Two immigrant children have now died in U.S. custody over the past month. And Mitt Romney kicks off the race for an Oscar in 2019 with an op-ed in the Washington Post. Should also say Louis C.K. won't be kicking off a bid to host the Oscars, but may instead be vying for a speaking role at CPAC. Trump starts the year with a third of his executive heads acting like their cabinet heads. Meanwhile, Trump's EPA on a mission to destroy the environment to ostensibly protect it. Tomorrow, Dems to vote on PAYGO, amongst other House rules. And Trump starts to back up on Syria. Drawdown will now be in 4 months. I'm betting it will never happen.
Easy does it.
Let's slow down. It's got to be measured. America is losing its teachers by driving them away. And 2019 will be no different from 2018 insofar as workers will get screwed by private equity. All this and more on the first episode of the Majority Report in 2019. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are all here except for Matt, who could not break away from the frozen tundra
He's keeping it real.
He is in the heartland of the heartland. Now, of course, Brooklyn is the true heartland of America. Everybody knows that. It's we're on a navigable waterway, multiple navigable waterways, we're surrounded by real heartland values. But Matt likes to go to the other heartland, which is in North Dakota.
Yeah, he's a flyover state elite.
Plains exactly. Elites.
Exactly. And where they, where guys like Robert Kramer, was that his name? The new senator from North Dakota?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, I'll tell you something. I still remember watching that video of him on a local television program trying to answer about Kavanaugh and thinking, if people vote for this guy in North Dakota after this showing, there is nothing that will ever keep them from voting. Like, just forget about it. The only answer is to populate the state and essentially overtake them. And I feel quite strongly that, you know,
Matt's been working on a leftist homesteaders act to retake over his home state.
I was just going to say.
He was snow plowing with Heidi Heitkamp.
I mean, honestly, if I'm Tom Steyer and I'm thinking I'm going to dump, you know, aside from like my own sort of vanity race, but I'm going to dump $100 million or $200 million or $300 million into this project, you know, the best thing might be to just sort of say like $150,000 to anybody who can show me that they vote, left of center, for the past two elections, and you get $100,000 bonus for moving there if you stay there for, you know, I'll give you 50 each year for that you stay there, or 35 or something like that. Some program like a homesteading act, but just privately funded by Tom Steyer, and set up these little communities. I think that's,
maybe that's why Matt's still there. He's populating the state with red diaper babies as we speak.
Well, I'm sure Matt's going to be excited to hear that that's what we think he's doing.
I, not to be insulting, do not think that that's what Matt is doing. I think he's populating the state with the exhalation of his weed smoke.
That's great. I'm sure he'll appreciate that just as
Which
much.
Is fine. Yeah, I was going to say.
Jamie says all he's doing is fornicating, and all you say is he's getting high. So
there could be a middle way.
Not mutually exclusive.
Planning an episode of Literary Hangover, I think he's playing, while playing Red Dead Redemption.
Right, I was going to say.
He and just getting brought high his game and fornicating. He's multitasking.
I hope everyone had a happy New Year. Let me say happy belated New Year to you. Also, happy belated Haitian Independence Day. We are rested, hopefully. You are too, because it's going to start getting crazy again quickly. And you're going to be busy right off the bat. Tomorrow, the Democrats will be voting on a suite of new House rules. And every incoming Congress and both houses have this opportunity. The Senate's going to be voting for rules, but most of those rules have already been essentially instituted by the Senate, because the Republicans have been controlling it for some time. But Democrats come in. They come in with a new host of rules. One of them is going to be we'd already talked about the idea of the rule that if you were going to raise taxes on anybody but the top 20%, you needed 2/3 of the House. That was dispatched with. There is another rule called the Gephardt rule, which came from Dick Gephardt in, I believe, he was the House Democratic leader in the late 70s and into the 80s. I can't help but think.
I think it was the 80s through Pelosi, actually. Or maybe the 90s through Pelosi, not the 70s.
Maybe I'm getting confused. But nevertheless, the Gephardt rule was about basically including every time that you know, there's two aspects to congressional expenditures. One is they make the expenditures, and that is they pass a budget, theoretically. And then later in the year, there is a debt ceiling vote, which has to happen. And that vote is not to actually expend money that has already been that money has already been expended. That money has already been appropriated. It is essentially a vote to decide to pay the bill. So it's not an elegant metaphor, but it's like you go and buy a new T-shirt and you use your credit card. When you make the decision to spend the money is when you bought the T-shirt, not when you pay the bill on the credit card. Now, we have never defaulted in the history of this country on U.S. Treasury bills. And if you were not to raise the debt ceiling, that's what you would do. However, Republicans, now Democrats have time to time voted against it, and it is a symbolic vote, never really threatening not to raise the debt ceiling. Republicans have, over the past now 10 years, made a real threat to do so, which would, in many respects, possibly crash the economy. The Gephardt rule basically says when you expend the money, when you vote on the budget, we're also going to tuck in a thing that automatically raises the debt ceiling so that this can no longer be used as a a Republican hostage. And so that is in the new pack of new congressional rules that's restoring Congress for the people. I have it here in my hand. And then the other one, which is going to get voted on tomorrow, is the PAYGO rules. And the PAYGO we've talked about, it basically says you cannot vote to appropriate any money unless it is offset by cuts or raises in taxes. In other words, no deficit spending. And in fact, you can't even spend when there's a surplus unless you pay for it. We have talked about the uselessness of this provision in terms of retail politics. There is no constituency out there for this. The myth that anybody cared about deficits is, I would hope, has been blown away. There is no political salience to this. There's just no value. To the extent that there is, all it does is it handicaps an ability for progressives, for the left, for liberals, anybody on the left, to put in any program they want. It inhibits their ability to do so. Does it make it impossible? No, but it inhibits it seriously. There needs to be 18 Democrats who essentially say, I am not going to support PAYGO. It's got to go before I vote on this host of new rules. Ro Khanna has made that number now 17 by announcing, I think this morning, that he would not be voting to support PAYGO. Here he is with a video explaining why. This is Ro Khanna, representative from California 17th, and he explains it.
People hear the word PAYGO, they tune out, they think it's some inside baseball technical jargon related to Congress. Let me tell you, it is a very important issue. It would be unilateral disarmament for House Democrats to adopt PAYGO. The Republicans never did. They passed massive tax cuts for the 1%, and they didn't have any spending cuts to pay for those tax cuts. They never do. They don't ever balance the budget.
There's the Republican tax reform bill that emerged from the U.S. House of Representatives ran into new obstacles. The Congressional Budget Office reported that it would add at least $1.7 trillion to deficits over 10 years.
As the president noted, today we received the largest military budget in history.
The budget deficit will balloon to $1 trillion by the year 2020.
Yeah, this is something that Wall Street's been expecting. Private forecasters had said we would be seeing $1 trillion deficits because of the president's tax reform bill.
Now that House Democrats are in charge, some folks want us to limit our policies by adopting PAYGO. Here's what it would mean. If we have PAYGO, then to do something like Medicare for All, to do something like expanding Social Security, to do something like a bold infrastructure plan or a Green New Deal would require us to negotiate against ourselves. We would require cuts in programs that many of us value and like. We shouldn't do that. The Republicans didn't govern that way. Instead of doing the politically expedient thing in seeking cuts that are not necessary, what we ought to do is the principled thing. We ought to argue that our policies are actually going to grow the economy, that these investments are in the interests of the United States. PAYGO would be a terrible policy. It's exactly the type of weakness that people don't want to see. They want House Democrats to be bold, to offer our vision, and to offer a real alternative to what the House Republicans did.
There you go. So now that number is down to 17. It would be worth your while to call members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Hopefully they're in your district, but if they're not, do one that's close to your district. Call and tell them to vote against PAYGO. The more that the members of the House are aware that you're aware of this, this is one of those things that they usually just pass and never becomes a political issue at all, because who cares? I can tell you that most of the normies out there, and by that I use that term as just, you know, people who don't spend all their time talking about politics. Well, just about, as far as I can tell, everybody does now. But
it's normie to talk.
But I would say, like,
now.
but aren't, you know, the people who are not listening to 3 hours a day of politics, let's put it that way, they don't know what PAYGO is. And if you explain it to them very quickly, they're going to be bothered by it because it completely handicaps. It's not saying that you can't have offsets. It's just that by putting the default this way, it makes it much, much harder to get good policies and promote them. And so if members of the House suddenly realize, like, oh, people are paying attention to this now, I'm not going to vote for it. That will be the dynamic. So I encourage you. Do we have a number? We'll get a number where you can call Congress, and we'll put it up under this video, and certainly we'll tweet it out, and we'll talk about it in a moment. But
he got a nice signal boost from our girl Alexandria, so that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people, I would be surprised if there aren't already a couple of other people who are going to come out and, you know, announce that they're voting against this. But hopefully one of you guys is actually Googling a number to call your Congress.
In a certain sense.
202-225-3121. That's your House member. 202-225-3121. 3121. 202-225-3121. Thank you, Crack Google. So that's going to be the big fight. Also, you should know that the Democrats, and this is, again, not necessarily, this is, you know, again, more politics, nothing specifically. What we're going to be seeing over the next year is the Democrats positioning themselves. Now, look, that's the thing about the PAYGO, is that they can't do anything anyways, unilaterally. But we are now setting precedents and setting stuff up for 2021 with the hopes that there will be a democratically controlled House and Senate and a Democrat and president sitting in the executive. I mean, that's basically what's going on here. And this also defines the parameters of what becomes the mainstream conversation. What politics are allowed, essentially, amongst the political class, which is why it's so important to do it now. Democrats are going to, among other things, in the investigations regarding Trump, et cetera, and just the massive corruption throughout our government, and also, you know, harassing the EPA. How is it you're justifying? We'll talk about this. How is it you're justifying putting more mercury into the air? We will talk about how they're justifying it. But one of the things, provision in the opening days rule package is it's authorizing the House counsel. I mean, this is the other thing, resources. Lawyers for the Congress will be able to intervene in the lawsuit in which 16 Republican-controlled states are, or formerly controlled Republican states, are trying to essentially find the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. The House lawyers are going to specifically be weighing in on the pre-existing conditions feature. As Nancy Pelosi says, let's hear it for pre-existing conditions. But hopefully they'll get the politics a little bit more
electrifying.
Yes, than that. And then three chairs for pre-existing conditions. But that's basically what's happening there. In terms of the shutdown, here's the deal. There are hundreds of thousands of government workers right now who are not getting paid. Well, let me do this first. This is actually a timely ad for today. If you're trying to drink more water this year, you're trying to stay more hydrated, and this is actually one of those circumstances where I lean on Liquid IV more when I have been drinking a little bit. Liquid IV hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone, with the added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, and B12. That also helps you absorb the hydration quicker. It's not your average electrolyte drink mix, Liquid IV. It uses cellular transport technology in a specific ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium to help your body absorb more water and nutrients directly into your bloodstream. It can provide the same hydration as drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. So I will tell, well, it contains more vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. The portable powder packets are perfect for throwing in your gym bag to fuel a tough workouts and prevent muscle fatigue. On nights that I have been drinking, and I have extended this recommendation to friends of mine, I drink a packet of this. I mean, that's the way I use it. I don't go to the gym probably as much as I should, but I do have occasion where I've drank too much. And this has been incredibly helpful because it's hard to drink 3 bottles of water. It's easier to drink 1 bottle of water. I also have found, frankly, it's helping with a little bit of the bags under my eyes.
Really?
Yeah, because that's apparently because I've been a little bit dehydrated.
Hello.
I mean, that's not, they don't tell you to say that, but that's what I found. And I actually get complaints in the office that I don't keep enough of that around here. So
very greedy with it.
But I've got good news for you, Michael. Mm-hmm. As you know, you love Liquid IV. I do too. But right now, my listeners and even my producers can get 20% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 20% off of anything you order at Liquid IV's website. Just go to liquidiv.com. Enter my promo code MAJORITY to get your savings and start getting better hydration. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Get hydrated today. Okay, so we have currently working without pay. And this is a partial shutdown because there was already a statute passed earlier in the year that provided for pay for the majority, I think, of government workers. But in addition to the hundreds of thousands who are have been furloughed, they're not getting paid and they're not working. We have 54,000 custom and border protection agents getting working without pay, 42,000 Coast Guard employees, 53,000 TSA agents, 17,000 correctional officers, 14,000 FBI agents, 4,000 DEA, 5,000 fighters who are with the U.S. Forest Service. These are all people who are paying to go to work, essentially, at this point, right? Because they're not getting paid, paying for their transportation, whatever it is. A decent number of these people, I would say, good time for you to go find other work. I'm not terribly excited about what the Customs and Border Protection people are doing these days. But, I mean, obviously some of this is necessary, but all of this is a struggle. I mean, all of these people have families. These are their jobs. We have hundreds of thousands of other workers. You're going to start seeing, as of today, Smithsonian closing. You're going to start seeing more public parks closing. And not only, I mean, just contemplate this. The administration, the Office of Personnel Management, last Thursday, I think it was, they tweeted out advice to furloughed federal workers on how to explain their situation to creditors and landlords. They also gave a sample letter And it went like this, quote, I will keep in touch with you to keep you informed about my income status. And I would like to discuss with you the possibility of trading my services to perform maintenance. Wow. Painting, carpentry work in exchange for partial rent payments. Now, banks are well known for taking like, yeah, if you've got a mortgage with us and you'd rather come in and make some shelves or perhaps organize our files, feel free to come in. This is also hitting with a lot of times, like you had a lot of federal workers who they don't know when their next paycheck is going to come. They're not going to go expend money on presents for their kids. They're all the human suffering here, really, just needless suffering, is pretty stunning. What will also happen is there's a couple of thousand federal contractors. You know, in a lot of the buildings, subcontractors, a lot of federal buildings. So you have janitors, security guards, people who work in like the commissaries. And they will never get back pay. They don't come in. These companies are never going to give them back pay. Many of these workers who are furloughed right now or who are working without pay, we're talking about 800,000 total. Hopefully they will get back pay. But the bottom line is right now they're having to go out and they're either taking loans or they're putting stuff on their credit card. They're never going to get paid for the interest that they're going to get charged on their credit card. The 20% interest. That money's never coming back. The insecurity that they're dealing with, that they're cutting back in real time, the stress that their kids and themselves are probably going through, this is never going to get returned. In addition to that, it undermines the missions of all of these agencies if they cannot count on funds coming in. All their contracts, right? You're going to be putting contractors out of business. You're going to be putting people out of business who do business with the government. So this is problematic. It reverberates. And so here's what's going to happen. Probably tomorrow or maybe Friday, the House is going to pass a budget with, I don't know, if there'll be $1.5 billion for, border security or whatever that means. Look, they could pass the $5 billion and Donald Trump's not going to be able to build anything other than more replicas of his prototype walls, for the most part, because it's a drop in the bucket. But the bottom line is, if you're going to give him $5 billion for to pretend that he's building his wall, get something, get permanent status for DACA kids, get permanent status for DAPA. And that was the deal they had a year ago. And of course, Stephen Miller said, told Trump, don't do it, or Trump, who knows, but, the House is going to pass a budget and then it's going to go to the Senate and Mitch McConnell is going to have to make a decision. He's either going to, put that up for a vote and it will pass, because there'll be Democrats who will vote for it. He's also got to worry, though, that there's a half a dozen senators who are going to pretend, Republican senators who are going to pretend that it's a problem, right? Like Ted Cruz is going to get out there and this is going to be his time to shine. And Mike Lee is going to get out there. Rand Paul is going to say, this is, I finally have principles and blah, blah, blah. Then the bill, if it passes in the Senate, will go to Donald Trump. And then he will presumably not sign it. And it becomes a pocket veto. Maybe he will veto it just to show it. And then it goes back to the House and the Senate. And then things start getting really interesting. It will most likely pass the House. But in the Senate, there could be enough Republicans who are afraid of voting against Donald Trump. But who knows? Ultimately, I don't think this works out very well for the Republicans. But it's, like I say, a lot worse for the federal workers and the federal government. And this is the rub. This is why when we talk about asymmetrical politics, this is it, because it's a problem for people on the left most that the government is hurt and that federal workers are hurt by this. And the hurt continues and gets worse as you go on. So the leverage is with the Republicans, but Donald Trump is about to own this. And despite the fact that he already announced that he was going to own it, he's going to own it in a an even more intimate way very shortly.
You want to talk about asymmetrical politics. Public sector workers are not allowed to strike in most states because, you know, their jobs are too important. They help society run. But the Republicans are allowed to do the exact same thing if they decide to.
It's that's basically not fair. A lockout. Right? It's basically a lockout for all those people who are furloughed. And it's even worse for those people who are not furloughed, but don't get paid. Yeah, no, it's a real problem. I don't know how you make a long-term reform to this, but that's why there has to be a political price exacted, because otherwise it continues to happen. And we shall see. I mean, hopefully that we'll see a price paid. Meanwhile, this happened while we were out. Elizabeth Warren, she makes an announcement. Let's watch part of the video. This is it's 4 minutes long, right? We're not going to watch the whole thing, but let's watch a little bit of it. Elizabeth Warren has essentially, I mean, I don't know if this is official, but she said she's going to launch a
exploratory committee.
Committee.
Can we be a little pedantic for a second? I've never understood this, and I've been doing this for a little while now. When you explore, how many people launch an exploratory committee that doesn't turn into a run? That's exceedingly rare, right?
I would say zero.
What is the specific? Is it legal? Is it something you have to do to set up certain
mechanisms?
It's
the way that you can start taking money.
Oh, okay, got it.
And the idea is, I mean, there's a lot of theories as to why she announced now. One, slow news days right now, gets more attention. You launch the exploratory committee, you get a news hit. You announce that you're going to run, you get another news hit. That's the theory, I think. The other idea is, if she can raise a lot of money, it will scare some people out of the race. That is the other theory. Here is her video, which I guess introduces the idea that she's planning to run.
In our country, if you work hard and play by the rules, you ought to be able to take care of yourself and the people you love. That's a fundamental promise of America.
Pause it for one second. Now, I should tell you, that construct was a Bill Clinton construct.
I was just going to say
that. We can debate the value of that. I mean, better that you're using some type of like folksy phrase from Bill Clinton than Ronald Reagan. Let me put it that way. And so, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that's what Democrats would do. They would put, they would start their videos with, we can be a shining beacon, you know, for the world or something. And so we're making some progress, but go ahead.
This should be true for everyone. Growing up in Oklahoma, that promise came through for me and my family. After my older brothers joined the military and I was still just a kid, my daddy had a heart attack and couldn't work. My mom found a minimum wage job at Sears, and that job saved our house and our family. My daddy ended up as a janitor, but he raised a daughter who got to be a public school teacher, a law professor, and a senator. We got a real opportunity to build something. Working families today face a lot tougher path than my family did. And families of color face a path that is steeper and rockier, a path made even harder by the impact of generations of discrimination. I've spent my career getting to the bottom of why America's promise works for some families, but others who work just as hard slip through the cracks into disaster. And what I've found is terrifying. These aren't cracks that families are falling into. They're traps. America's middle class is under attack. How do we get here? billionaires and big corporations decided they wanted more of the pie. And they enlisted politicians to cut them a fatter slice. They crippled unions so no one could stop
them. We're going to turn the bull loose.
Dismantled the financial rules meant to keep us safe after the Great Depression. And cut their own taxes so they paid less than their secretaries and janitors.
It's time to write the rules for the middle class.
After Wall Street crashed our economy in 2008, I left the classroom to go to Washington and confront the broken system head on.
Elizabeth Warren, apparently not afraid to tangle with Wall Street.
Elizabeth Warren is heading into the lion's den.
Mrs. Warren goes to Washington.
She did.
We created America's first consumer watchdog to hold the big banks accountable.
A woman who has warned of another meltdown if Washington doesn't straighten up.
I never thought I'd run for office, not in a million years. But when Republican senators tried to sabotage the reforms and run me out of town, I went back to Massachusetts and ran against one of them. And I beat him.
And we are going to turn Washington back to the people.
Yeah! Who do we love?
Warren!
Who do we love?
Warren!
Who do we love?
Warren!
Today, corruption is poisoning our democracy.
One.
Politicians look the other way while big insurance companies deny patients life-saving coverage, while big banks rip off consumers, and while big oil companies destroy this planet. Our government's supposed to work for all of us, but instead, it has become a tool for the wealthy and well-connected. The whole scam is propped up by an echo chamber of fear and hate designed to distract and divide us. People who will do or say anything to hang on to power point the finger at anyone who looks, thinks, prays, or loves differently than they do.
Build that wall.
But this dark path doesn't have to be our future. We can make our democracy work for all of us. We can make our economy work for all of us. We can rebuild America's middle class. But this time, we gotta build it for everyone.
All right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, the interesting thing about that video as you watch it is early on, she addresses, you know, the economic plight of not just, you know, the middle class, but also of specifically of minorities in this country. And then everything else is, I think, sort of very, in maybe slightly different rhetoric, but certainly populist in tone, and attacking the big banks, attacking the insurance companies, and then also, you know, throws in some resistance stuff. You know, she flashes a picture of AOC and, you know, among other sort of incoming, you know, leftist, I guess, at least in the context of the Democratic Party, House members. And so I don't know. It's interesting because this is where you see at least she plans to go early on. And that is, I think, to attempt to secure those supporters of Bernie Sanders.
I think, let me say, I mean, I agree with, I think, first of all, what I like about it is just reminding everybody of why we all liked her in the first place and getting away from the sort of recent mishap with the DNA thing and reminding us that she's has a really powerful record on banks and consumer issues. And that's how she, the only reason she's here is because of great work in that regard. And I don't want to get too nitpicky about rhetoric, but I do think, to me, like the old Clinton line points to basically just a bigger difference of opinion. And I think she does, within a much more genuine populist way, have much more belief in the American meritocracy than I do. And I think Sanders does. And that's an actual difference between a somewhat more democratic socialist position and a progressive liberal one. And I think it's actually could be great if the debate is on the merits of those things, but we shouldn't pretend that they're the same or that they're as systemic. And I also think, ironically, that, and I've been banging on about this, but it's true that when Bernie ran in 2016, I loved what he said about Kissinger, and I loved how he moved a bit on Israel-Palestine, but he had no foreign policy. In fact, he said some ridiculous things about teaming up with Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Now, he is the leader with regards to Yemen, as an example. So that's created a whole other justification. And if, as applied to her, I'd really like to see her remind us of why she was so good to begin with, banks and regulation, and she's got to move forward on a vision of the world.
Yep. Yep.
He, don't hold your breath.
He's
on
miles
that.
Beyond any to. Other mainstream politician on Israel, too.
Just without a doubt. And I'm not 100% convinced that in this environment that it's totally good enough to, you know, just have a, like, you know, butter at home, guns abroad foreign policy. Because I think that people who do talk intelligently about Obama's legacy on the Iran deal, that's a great way of intersecting a left perspective and some of the resistance rhetoric and guarding Obama's legacy and the racialized attacks on it. Also Israel, also what's happening across the world. I mean, you know, Bolsonaro was sworn in yesterday. I know we'll get to it. But the social media accounts of government workers are already being combed through in that country. It's a Trump wet dream.
So there's Elizabeth Warren. And
sorry for that image.
No. Let's take a quick phone call. I know we're not in the fun half yet, but I want to do this because calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Sorry for that image.
No. Let's take a quick phone call. I know we're not in the fun half yet, but I want to do this.
Who's this?
Hello, Sam. How you doing?
Hello, it's John from San Antonio. I thought it might be you, John, and I saw that you were hanging on the line, calling early today. And let me get your quick. First off, let me say Happy New Year's to you. What is your sense, Elizabeth Warren? I know you're a Bernie guy, but Bernie is yet to declare. Maybe he won't declare. What is your sense of Elizabeth Warren?
Well, I'm glad she's running. If Bernie doesn't declare, I'm glad that she's going to be, somebody who's going to help to some degree, you know, middle class and working class people. I'm not totally sold on her. I'm still going to be looking at Merkley and if he decides to run. But, you know, my heart is definitely, you know, in it for Bernie. And so, I agree with what Michael and Jamie both said. And I think that the fact that he put out this really great piece in an email yesterday that was published in Common Dreams, in the new year, let us resolve to fight, and this is the key words here, like we have never fought before for a government, a society, and an economy that works for all of us, not just those on top, you know. So, I mean, Brent Baer, on his Fox show on December 12th said, you know, if there's grassroots support, I'll run. And in a fundraising email on December 27th, he also said, if I'm the best candidate to beat Donald Trump, I'll probably run. And that is the truth. And so, you know, Bernie's consistently, you know, had the second best hypotheticals against Trump, including besides this latest Harvard X poll. It had a lead of 10.3% against Trump. And, you know, I was just looking at Biden's numbers from 2008, you know, he got less than 1% in Iowa, 0.2% in New Hampshire. Bernie received over 13 million votes. So, you know, I just think that Bernie is the real candidate that true progressives want. And, you know, also, you know, Warren has definitely been hurt by this video that she put out, concerning her Native American heritage. And so, I mean, her numbers have really gone down. And I think they'll, you know, rise up again because of the publicity. And I think it was a smart move to actually announce early. And I wish Bernie would announce. And I also want to encourage everybody on December 12th, there's going to be organizing.
December 12th?
No, I'm sorry, January 12th.
I was going to say.
There's going to be all these organizing events let me see, what is it? Organizingforbernie.com. Go to that website and you can click on find an event. I know I've already signed up for the event here in San Antonio. And, I encourage everybody to go to these events and show Bernie just how much we want him as a candidate. And because, I mean, to me, he's ready to run. He just needs that extra support from all of his followers. And, the Bernie followers are definitely more committed than any other followers that are out there. And, and it's all about, it's not a, I mean, I think he is a charismatic politician, and we've had that disagreement a little bit, but, it's mostly about his policy. And, right. People want him to run. And I have to say that, great opening on PAYGO. PAYGO is a big opening vote. AOC has already said, that she's not going to vote for PAYGO. And so now it's down to 16 people. So I just want to encourage all of the best progressives and even centrists that, PAYGO is a really important
You can go to mycongress.com as well to find out, how to call. And yeah, that's a big deal, I think.
I'm glad that you filled it in with some numbers and details, John, because I am more of a big picture person, but I came to the same conclusions as you, looking at, the larger social forces at play. I think none of the social forces that brought us Trump have changed substantially since 2016. If anything, they have intensified. And I just think that Warren would lose really badly to Trump. What's happened already doesn't bode well for the future.
Why? Wait a second. And why do you think, I mean, look, the arguments of electability right now, I think, are silly, broadly speaking. But why do you think Warren would lose badly to Trump?
Okay. People don't only vote based on policy. People vote based on vibe, as much as we would like them to vote based on policy.
Right.
And she has a very similar vibe to Hillary Clinton.
That's exactly my point.
She's not channeling she's not channeling the populist rage in the same way that Bernie is. But if you want to talk about policy too, I think the only wiggle room in this election, it's in two places, right? It's in this small slice of working class swing voters who could go back and forth. Although if you voted for Trump, I'm not sure that many of these people are coming back from that, but some. And those people want to see, policies that help them. They also want to see, someone with an angry vibe, and some of them are probably sexist too. So that might be on Bernie's side. But also, and like more importantly, you need to turn out the people who don't usually vote. And that's how Jeremy Corbyn did it. When he increased the turnout among young people from like 30% to like 78% or something like that. And those people are more important.
Okay. So if you say that she has a similar vibe to Hillary Clinton, despite the fact of her policies not being, not being consistent. So let's just say for the moment that Bernie Sanders does not run. If Bernie Sanders does not run, he's clearly going to support Elizabeth Warren. And the idea that Bernie Sanders is not going to get you an extra 10,000 votes in Michigan and an extra 10,000 votes in Wisconsin, and particularly after what we saw in 2016, and with all the women who came out and drove, 2018, who drove record numbers.
Did it work for Obama getting votes for Hillary?
What?
Obama wasn't going out. Actually, Obama was hurting Hillary, I think, with the TPP. I think the net value of Obama was very small. But wait a second. Let me finish. But again, the idea that Bernie's not going to get 10,000 votes for her in Wisconsin and in Michigan is absurd. Like, the margin was so small, and there were so many different factors that led to Hillary Clinton, who I think was, particularly in that time, as a candidate, uniquely ill-suited to run against Donald Trump in that time. I mean, I still contend that Martin O'Malley would have won. And so the idea that people, I mean, look at, Donald Trump didn't even do as well as Mitt Romney as a share of the vote. And so you know, to totally discount the idea that what people have been saying for 2 and 3 and 4 years, that Hillary Clinton was a uniquely bad candidate, will somehow, that the next person who is not a uniquely bad candidate, who doesn't rightly or wrongly have 30 years of baggage, like literally people who made lifetimes of income.
Let me just,
based upon attacking the Clintons.
May I?
There's no data to support this whatsoever.
May I just offer another viewpoint that I'm going to be hammering, at least until we get more like numbers in, and maybe this becomes like a more tangible argument we can have about electability. I think that there's a very good chance, and a lot of conditions are in play, but I don't think it's inconceivable that I won't say all of them, but I think several of these people could beat Trump, including ones I really don't like. I think Biden would smoke him. I think Bernie Sanders would smoke him. So my argument is going to be Bernie Sanders is the best candidate if he runs, and I strongly support him, and none of it is going to hinge on these electability.
It's way too early to make any type of electability argument.
Let's flip it, though, because I would say, like, that's always used against the left. So let me just say,
definitely.
I think anybody could win. So let's go with the best one.
That's exactly right. I think at this point, to talk about electability, particularly when there's no data, I mean, there's no data that's worthwhile at all. You know, I mean,
just gave us some data.
Well, yeah, but that data is worthless. Like, you can go back to two years out of any campaign, and it is, you know, Jeb was leading at this point.
Didn't Joe Lieberman lead the field in 2004?
Yeah, I mean, we're too far out. But also, you could argue that Bernie has more, like, right now there's more data that supports that he's electable. But to say that Elizabeth Warren is not electable is absurd.
Well, and
People vote against candidates in these elections.
And may I just say, more relevant to debunk is a lot of polling coming out saying that actually Bernie Sanders is unusually popular with people of color and less popular with white people, as an example. So there's a lot of lies about his support base we can debunk with the numbers that are already established. But I want to just move in the opposite direction and say, I think that especially if the trends right now hold with where Trump's approval ratings are, where the economy's going, and what happened in 2018, he probably will lose. And I want to take this opportunity to nominate somebody that will actually make fundamental structural changes and not just kick the can down the road with a depressing centrist DLC 4 years that won't change the material conditions you're talking about.
And I will say that I think, honestly, at this juncture, making the electability argument is the most detrimental force to getting a better candidate from the perspective of the left. Because the electability is exactly what you will hear to discount anybody coming from the left. In fact, and John, I appreciate the call, buddy.
I agree with you, John.
Here is a perfect example, right, of where the center is, the so-called center. And by the center, I mean really the center right. Is going to take this. It's all based upon an electability argument. No one has a sense of who is electable right now. The only genuine data that you can look at is what happened in the last presidential election, what happened in the midterms, what has happened traditionally. The Republican presidential candidate in 6 out of the last 8 elections, 7 out of the last 8 elections, has gotten less of a share of the popular vote. And yes, it is the case that you can lose the election if you don't get those 15,000 votes in Michigan and the 15,000 votes in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania. But I will remind everybody, 40,000 in Pennsylvania, I will remind everybody that what happened in the midterm elections, dramatic change there in terms of swinging back and record number of Democratic voters. So the idea that electability is a real thing for really any of these Democratic candidates, particularly at this point. I mean, you need to see people out on the campaign trail, and there can be some really god-awful campaigners. But there's just simply not enough evidence at this point. But here is...
I would love to be wrong about this.
Well, yeah,
I'm looking
I would
at
love
the grand
you to be wrong
sweep of history, though, and right-wing populism is the result largely of capitalist crisis, and that's not going away.
I understand.
It's going to intensify.
I understand. The capitalist crisis is going to intensify, but the fact is 3 million more people voted for a deeply flawed candidate who was literally up until the moment of her campaign going out and speaking to the villains of the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, there is nothing. We have no analog. And there is no indication that Donald Trump is getting more popular than he was in 2016.
It's also just
there's
not
also
so.
There's no
also
indication that turnout would increase
it's
among
also
Democrats.
Just, it's also
or
just
likely
not so.
Yes. No, you're wrong. We just saw the greatest turnout of Democrats in a midterm election in any of our lifetimes and since Watergate, beyond Watergate. So you're wrong about that fundamental point. There is every reason to believe that Democratic turnout is going to be gangbusters.
Well, it was a totally impotent turnout.
I mean, honestly,
is anybody like the stroke of callback or whatever the hell his name is? Yeah, it was impotent, Sam.
Right.
Impotent.
So, I mean, that's absurd. There. I mean, look, I'm not being a wallflower here. But the fact is that every data point that you bring up, actually, there's, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 2 years.
No, I mean, you're totally right. I just think a better driver of turnout even than Warren's very progressive policies is someone who says, yeah, the system is broken. It's rigged against you. It's fucked. And I'm going to change it on a structural level rather than tinker with it to make it better.
I mean, if you really think that there is a huge swath of people out there who are waiting for the word structural, as opposed to everything else you said, which was just in her video.
Not the word.
Well, what? I mean, like honestly, like she hit all those notes. Now, it's quite possible that she's not a great campaigner or that there's other problems that are going to come up or that the DNA thing is going to haunt her. But we're trying to analyze here, like, you know, sort of like what the situation is with these candidates. And I get it. Bernie's better. I get that. But everything that you are basing on that Elizabeth Warren doesn't have a chance right now in 2020, that she is unelectable. When you say she is unelectable,
Bernie might be unelectable too.
Well, everybody might be
unelectable. Honestly,
I understand. But Bernie has not declared.
Trump might be unelectable.
Right. I think Donald Trump is unelectable, probably, if there is, to be honest with you. And so, you know, the enormous amount of factors that align to make it impossible for Hillary Clinton to win are not going to be involved in this go round.
It was an impotent showing, Sam.
I mean,
you're steamrolling over the truth. Or you're apathetic.
Apathetically
steamrolling. No, that would be aggressively.
Well, let me get back to this argument that we keep hearing over and over again, that the left is unelectable. Okay. And in this case, it's coming from a guy who just lost his incumbency. This is outgoing Senator Joe Donnelly with a warning to his party. And, well, let's listen to it first before I recharacterize what he's saying.
Your party, about the Democratic Party. You lost in Indiana in November. McCaskill, we just talked about, lost in Missouri. Heidi Heitkamp lost in North Dakota. The Democratic Party was already receding to the coasts, even more so now. So can the Democratic Party, your party, be viable without appealing to the interior of the country where you live and where you represent?
Boy, I don't know how you do that. I mean, I was fortunate enough. I got more votes in this midterm than any Democrat in Indiana in modern history. But it wasn't quite enough because the president came three times in about the last week, six times in about the last month and a half, and said, this is about him. And he said, if you don't vote, basically, you're betraying me. And we have not made enough of a connection. I work like a dog nonstop to make that connection. But that the people of my state understand that culturally, we want to make sure you succeed, that we're going to fight to make sure that, for instance, on student loans, we'll keep the interest rate at the same rate as a housing loan. But when you talk Medicare for All, like I heard on the panel earlier, you start losing the people in my state. When we start talking about, hey, we're going to work together with the insurance companies to lower premiums, that's what connects. And so,
so wait a second.
All right, this guy definitely would lose to Trump.
Hold on, hold on. Right, right. So Joe Donnelly would have us believe that what the constituents of Indiana want to hear is not that you're going to get low, like really low, if not no cost insurance that you're not going to have to deal with. What his constituents want is that you're going to work together with the insurance company.
Don't you remember those Trump speeches right before the election?
Of course.
I'll tell you what, folks.
I'm going to work with the insurance people. Now,
and if you went to college, not going to be more than a home loan. No. Am I right? Am I right? Are we excited?
We love our loans.
We love our housing loans.
We love our housing loans. Here is a Kaiser Family Foundation poll, which states that over 50% of the people of Indiana, and apparently Joe Donnelly didn't have this poll, support Medicare for All. You can see if you go in there, we will zoom in to Indiana. Get in there. All right, there we go, right there. Now, that's a beautiful turquoise color. And if we go down to the key, we can see that turquoise is over 50%. Yeah, probably around 52, 53%. But it's not just that. First of all, this notion that he got the most votes of any Democrat state. Well, he's the incumbent. He was the incumbent for 6 years. And I will tell you that he really didn't do much better. There was another woman, Liz Watson. She ran for a House seat in the 9th district. Now, she lost by 13 points to her to an incumbent. She lost by 13 points to the incumbent, but she ran on Medicare for All. Donnelly lost by only 6 points, but then he lost by another 4 points to there was another 4 points from a Libertarian, which would have gone to the Republican, presumably, if they were not in the race. And there you're at, basically, 10 points. As the incumbent, he loses.
Sir, I'm underemployed and drowning in college debt, and I'd like to vote for a Democrat, but I'm just a little alienated by this talk of relieving my student debt. If you could just match it with a home loan, which, of course, I'll never be able to afford, I feel a lot more comfortable. That would connect with me.
It's all well and good that you're going to provide for me a basically no headache, no cost health insurance. But what I would rather see is you to sit down and actually come to a tete-a-tete situation with some big insurance corporation.
You said free health care at point of delivery, but where's the dialogue with Humana? see how that connects with me, man.
What we have just witnessed is Joe Donnelly's, if not, you know, this is one of his calling cards that he's going to, he's going to take that interview and he's going to take the link and it's going to be attached to his resume as he applies for lobbying positions in some massive law firm in Washington, D.C. on health insurance.
That's exactly right. He's literally
going to sell himself as being the guy who is going to go to these three senators. I can't think of who they are off the top of my head, but there's three or four of them that he is going to tell that partner of the law firm, I can get you that one, and that one. And those are the guys I will work on in the Senate to prevent Medicare for All in the event that, I mean, the one thing that Joe Donnelly wants more than anything is a Democratic takeover of the Senate so that he can get that lobbying job and stop Medicare for All.
And I just want to say...
And Claire McCaskill, same exact deal.
Same exact deal. And Dick Gephardt, who you mentioned earlier, there's audio from him from last year that I think Lee Fang dug up at some meeting. And he's like, we're never going to let single payer pass, period. And he's sort of like the prime former Democratic leadership influence peddler in Washington right now for everything, not just healthcare. Also even like not recognizing the Armenian genocide. And one of the great things, if you start to change the makeup of the Democratic House and in the future the Senate, is that these people won't be employable.
Exactly.
Because there'll be no use. There's no social capital.
All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. We will talk more about these. We've got more of this. Everybody, we're like, even Terry McAuliffe now. He's for Medicare for All, but he wants to put the brakes on some other things. I mean, they're all... All of these surrogates are going out there. They have slightly different agendas. Some are looking for lobbying jobs. Some are looking for lobbying jobs and also to support people who will help them in their lobbying jobs. So it's not just one note. We will talk about that more in the as the program goes on. Mike Pompeo says that Brazil is going to be an ally in their attempt to bring back democracy to Venezuela. And there's nothing like enlisting a burgeoning fascist state to help you bring back democracy in its neighbor.
Or to literally telegraph that that invasion is finally happening.
There you go.
That's incredibly disturbing stuff.
We will talk about that and more. We will also take your phone calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs. You can IM the show at majorityapp.com. See you in... You do plugs now, right? Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. When you become a member, you get access to an extra hour plus of content every day and the occasional special bonus for members, like that Brandon Tarkatoff interview that I did, or the debate,
Stroka?
Or whatever. Straka.
No, I don't remember. Whatever.
That guy. That
just apathetically
really
bulldozing over his last name.
The most smug and condescending that I've ever been for an extended period of time on camera, dressed in a hoodie, I would say. I'm just covering my bases there. So you can check that out. Today is Wednesday, which means that yesterday was Tuesday, but it was also New Year's Day. So what's going on with the TMBS?
Thursday night.
You still doing
special
that?
Thursday what? Night you, show tomorrow night.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, sir. Bhaskar Sunkara is in studio. We are going to talk about his new book, Socialism in 2019. We've got some stuff that we've got to cover, of course, in Brazil, but also in the Western Sahara, a bunch of other stuff. And then for patrons, the TMBS boys are doing a 2019 think tank session. It's a new kind of Patreon segment that we haven't done before, and you can watch it live tomorrow night at around 7-ish NYC time on our YouTube channel, of which we are on the verge of crossing our first 20,000 subscribers. So click the subscribe button over there and get your tickets to February 1st at the Bell House.
The other show is sold out, right?
Yeah, the majority sold out.
January 13th at the Bell House at 2:30 is sold out.
Okay.
But if you want to see me, because on that show... Just playing. I'll be at both.
He'll be at both. But you can get even up closer to Michael. He's going to be cordoned off.
That's right.
At the Majority Report show.
Quarantine.
We are selling extra VIP seats where you could actually sit closer to Michael.
Handshake.
Get all of his germs on you.
We sell rubber gloves if you want to shake hands with Michael, because that's
all
the only
migraines.
Way I'll do it.
It's no germs, guys.
Jamie, what's the story with the Antifada?
Yeah, so Sean and I actually took a week off this week because we were moving and it sucks, but we did put out an episode Christmas week that I have yet to plug on here. It was such a long time ago, I barely remember it. I'm just going to read this little description and hope that people find it interesting. So, on this episode, we're joined by geographer and filmmaker Dr. Nerv V. Makaspak to talk about the history of the Philippines, its Maoist insurgency, and the rise of Rodrigo Duterte. We also talk about Amazon, redlining, Marxist geography, and presidential foot fetishism. The last part of the episode is a discussion of Nerv's work on autonomous territories in Colombia, Mexico, and the Philippines that have earned some form of autonomy after decades of brutal armed struggle. Check it out, folks.
Check it out. The Christmas special of the Antifada. And I looked over at
Jesus
Matt's
was a nice man, but he said nothing new.
All right, folks.
Literary Hangover, Matt's podcast. Yes. It's really good. Really enjoyed. I'll keep flogging the Democracy in Chains one because I think that's a book that we should defend and read. I think that's an important book for understanding how the right works.
All right, folks, quick break. Head into the fun half, 646-257-3920. We'll turn on the IMs. You can get you can IM us through the app at majorityapp.com. Be right back.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.